Hello, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Devendra Hardawar, Senior Editor, and joining me is...
Reviews Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
And we are back for the very last episode of the year, and we figure this is a good time to take a look back and see what's good, what's bad, what really didn't work this year, and what we're looking forward to next year. As always, please subscribe to the Engadget Podcast, and if you're enjoying what we're doing, drop us a review where we can. Those one-star reviews, those are a lot of fun. Yeah, please, no more of those. But good reviews are great. We want more of that. Thank you. Sherlyn, you're not feeling well. We are getting ready for CES. The holidays are here. Everything just seems to be like crushing us right now.
Murphy's Law.
Yeah. I have to ask you, what is good? Like, what is one of the things you think really worked out this year for tech?
I mean, so I'm helping to put together Engadget's best and worst tech of the year coverage. And so, you know, I've got the whole team pitching. And it started off like everyone, I had a lot more nominations for best gadgets and devices than I did worst. So I was like, oh, this is pretty optimistic look on the year, right? And then they started grouping stuff together. Like the laptops, ultra portables were like, you know, all doing really well. And then the processors were all really good this year too.
Yeah.
And it actually got shorter and shorter. So actually we have a lot more terrible crap stuff this year than we do good stuff. But anyway, what I did like were laptops, surprisingly. Laptops were great this year. Not only, like, I think you're in agreement with me, right? They're getting thinner, faster, prettier, but also bigger screens.
Premium ultra portables like the Dell XPS 13 2-in-1 that I love so much, and the Spectre X 360, the new one that's sitting in front of me.
Yeah.
Like we've hit a good point in design. Like things just feel good. There's very little bezel around the screen. It's just like you can go into a store and buy a high-end laptop and be pretty happy with it.
It's gorgeous. I like that one so much. But also we saw the Dell XPS 13 2-in-1, which you fell in love with.
Love it.
And then there was the MacBook Pro 16, which you also reviewed. And it's
Yeah. The best Apple laptop in years. Like Apple went back and gave us a good keyboard, good power. I think even across the board, like we're seeing just really interesting things. I reviewed the Surface Laptop 3 15-inch version, and that one's really interesting. It has an AMD processor along with a bit of, Radeon mobile graphics. And that's a really interesting thing. It's a very thin machine, but they've managed to cram in a lot. So it just seems like in general, people are experimenting with the sorts of things laptops can be, and they're getting a lot more interesting.
I want to say, though, like even though I didn't like the Surface Pro X for some software related reasons, it was beautiful, like a gorgeous piece of hardware.
Sure.
That shows us what's possible if they get their software act together. And there was a lot of developments in connected PCs, which is something I like a lot, but hopefully we get to see more soon. I think Samsung also, you know, showed us that it had the chops to bring really good looking laptops to market with QLED screens. So I don't know. I just saw so many fascinating laptops this year.
Yeah.
And we reviewed more laptops than I think we ever have this year, maybe.
I can certainly feel it in my typing fingers. even in terms of gaming laptops, too, like things are getting pretty wild. I just reviewed the Razer Blade Stealth 13, the latest one, and they've managed to fit in a GTX 1650 Max-Q GPU in there. So that's like a dedicated graphics card in a really, really super light 3-pound machine. So really fascinating stuff happening across the board. Laptops are getting good, and you know, we'll keep an eye on the best ones.
I think you mentioned one of the key things too that made laptops really good this year, right? Like the AMD, it's just more powerful GTX chipsets, but it's also RTX chips were a whole thing this year too.
Oh, yeah.
Getting into a lot of laptops, they're getting just so much more powerful and yet remaining thin and relatively light, I guess. Acer unveiled, I think, the Concept D devices this year. We got a lot of Asus's Studio devices, so a lot of super powerful targeted at creators machines out there that I think will eventually trickle down to mainstream and be just very powerful.
Yeah, some really unique designs. Honestly, in terms of gaming laptops, I've been telling people for the past few years, I get a lot of questions from folks about, like, should I build a gaming desktop or something, or should I pick up a gaming laptop? And more, it just seems like, you know, it's worth spending the extra money. Get the laptop. Even though it's not upgradable, you could just do a lot more with it. You could game on the go. You could plug it in next to your TV and have something that's as powerful as, like, a modern console. And that is the sort of flexibility that we really haven't seen with gaming laptops up until recently. So yeah, those are looking much better than ever before. And another thing I've been really enjoying this year is just the overall growth of wireless earbuds. I've been resistant to these things for so long because, yeah, they haven't had great battery life and reception up until like recently. But this latest wave, everyone's getting in on the fun. We've got decent bud competition from just about every company, including Sony, Jabra, the usual suspects, but even like Microsoft has announced them. Google's going to give them another spin. Yeah, Amazon, which we will not speak of again. But it seems like the basic hardware to do wireless earbuds, you know, wireless chipsets that can really fit into those tiny spaces, decent battery life, and charging cases, like those, we figured out the basics of it. So everyone's just putting their spin on it right now. And Apple has even given us like their upgraded versions of the AirPods with the AirPods Pro. Noise canceling and everything. So it's a really cool space we're in. All of my concerns about wireless earbuds still exist. I still think like they're kind of annoying to deal with when you need to take them out. You got to keep the case around. They will fall onto the floor. You better hope they don't fall anywhere too gross or like out of reach. So
just be careful. Jeez.
No, they fall. They fall all the time. You drop that case will explode. That's happened to me many times. Like I will drop a case and the buds go flying all over the place. And that is, you know, with the earbuds that have cables to them, they at least stay in one location. But anyway, they're good. They're good. They're getting cheaper. And I think I can recommend so many different types of earbuds to people this year. A lot more companies are thinking more about form factor and kind of how they fit in your ears. So even the AirPods Pro have different bud sizes.
I mean, shout out to the Surface earbuds, right? Because they really worked on like that twist and lock mechanism, and Pixel also thought about how they want to seal out noise without
we won't see either of those until next year, but they're interesting ideas. And
the AirPods Pro, like you said, like people are really seriously thinking about the fit of their earbuds.
And the I mean, it's little things too. Like I believe Apple did a thing where like even the air pressure when you're wearing the earbuds kind of like equalize, which has been a bit of a problem for people with noise canceling headphones. Like you can sometimes feel like your ear is getting sucked out of your head when you turn on noise canceling. And apparently that's not a problem with the AirPods Pro. So little things like that, little, you know, ease of life features are pretty great. Quick shout out to, you know, the handful of earbuds out there that do a good job of staying in my very strange ears. If you have my physical dilemma, these are the buds you should be looking at. The Sony WF-1000XM3s, they're really high-end headphones. They fit well, even though they don't have wingtips. For exercise, I really like the new Beats wireless earbuds. You know, those have these really crazy arms. They go way over your ear, but you can also do anything. You could be running, you could be weightlifting, you could be doing whatever. They will not budge. So it seems like we're at a point where, you know, there's an earbud for every type of use and every type of person. Even some of our favorites from last year, Jabra, their new 75Ts fixed an already great pair of earbuds. Those are the ones I recommend for everybody. Like those seem like the best ones for most people, even if you're exercising, even if you need like very specific use cases. Basically, we only have two categories right now where I think we're mostly positive on it. Because otherwise, you know, it's been kind of a rocky year. I could talk a bit about VR. I think it's been both a great year for VR and also kind of a, you know, a bit of a disappointing one as well. This is kind of halfway. The Oculus Quest debuted this year, and that was sort of like the great all-in-one device everybody was waiting for. You don't need to plug in a phone. You don't need to plug it into a PC. It has all the hardware built in, and it has all of its sensors built in, too, for like full 6 degree of freedom VR. So you could play super hot. You could play all the games you've been hearing about, all for $400. So that was very nice when it launched. But over time, Oculus has actually made it a much more capable machine. So at the Kinect conference, they gave it this feature called Oculus Link that lets you plug into PC to run much more high-end VR. And they're also adding features like hand tracking. I'm really excited about this device. It is basically like the single most versatile VR headset out there. It's still very expensive, but for $400, you get a lot of machine. You get something that can do VR on the go. You get something that could do higher-end VR when you're in your, you know, home or office. It could just do so much, and it looks like it's going to be a great device into next year. I was also really impressed with the Valve Index, which is a whole, it's a crazy $1,000 setup, but it is the best high-end VR you could get. You know, it is still tethered to a PC. You still have to set up sensors, but everything looks so good. I feel like there's a type of user who will just pay whatever it takes to get the best looking VR possible.
On the opposite end of that high-end spectrum, though, didn't we see Daydream VR and die this year too? the ones that were based on Google Cardboard, or even like slightly higher end than that, like the Samsung's Gear VR headsets.
Every mobile VR platform died this year, but that's not too surprising. The only reason mobile VR was a thing was because, hey, our phones have these great screens. All we got to do is plug them into these little boxes, and you can sort of get like a semi-VR experience. And I think ever since the Oculus Go came out last year, Lenovo had the standalone Daydream device too, which honestly was not that impressive. Those were like basic takes on mobile VR, but once those things arrived, the Oculus Go was $200. Once those arrived, it didn't seem like you had a reason to plug your phone into a box anymore. And that's also a bad thing. At Oculus Connect this year, John Carmack, the legendary programmer who, you know, worked on Quake and so many different things, he is Oculus's head technology guy. And he was just saying, like, you know, it worked. They sold the Galaxy VR units, but they've noticed that, you know, it's really hard to have your main communication device in a box away.
Exactly.
Like if you're getting a text or something, it's kind of hard. Battery life wasn't great. There are just a lot of things that made it inconvenient. And it seems like the big thing for VR moving forward is it has to be convenient. And right now the Quest seems like the best option for most people. And I'm actually just working on a piece right now why next year is going to be a really, really big year for VR, mainly because of things like Half-Life Alyx, which is the prequel to Half-Life 2, but it's going to be an exclusive VR game in the Half-Life universe from Valve, a company that has seemingly forgotten how to make games beyond, like, you know, money-making mobile things. I'm not a fan of those, but that's the sort of thing. VR needs this killer app. Gamers are already freaking out that, I can't play this on my PC. I mean, I'm sorry, but that is the point. You got to get a headset. We need these big swings. I hope it's good. Judging from the trailer, it seems like it has some really interesting interactions. It'll be available across different headsets. I think the Quest and the upcoming features we're seeing there seem really fascinating too. And even like I'm looking at the next generation consoles, and those things are powerful enough to have some really good VR stuff. Sony says it'll be coming down the line. Microsoft is not a super fan of VR at this point.
I think that, for me this year, what really intrigued me in VR, I mean, you and I cover the VR Fest at Tribeca every year. And then, so I'm more familiar with those experiences that you go to a place and you strap in and, you know, they have all the gear for you. You just go and enjoy the experience. Mm-hmm. This year, The Void, I think, had the Marvel in VR, Avengers in VR experience. That, holy shit.
Did you do that? I forgot if you did that.
I covered the news. I didn't go, even though it was like right by my path station.
I thought you would have enjoyed it.
I would have, because the premise was very intriguing. But there's also an Iron Man VR game coming out. I believe it's coming to PSVR. And so it's titles like that. I think that content is a big deal for VR. And we are finally seeing, I think this year, actual efforts to make those good.
I mean, even last year, there was games I can't remember the titles of right now, but there was a big sci-fi game. There was a big like sword and sorcery game. There are big, long 20 to 30 hour games that you can experience in VR. So it seems like we're getting to a point where, like, you know, more stuff is happening. I feel like Sony support for VR has been essential, because the PlayStation VR was not a very powerful device because it was just relying on the PlayStation 4. But they got so many developers involved that they brought so much content into the VR ecosystem. So I'm hoping, you know, more stuff happens. It sounds like Sony wants to make a follow-up to the PlayStation VR for the PS5. Microsoft is doing this weird thing where it's like, they're just saying gamers don't want VR and they're kind of avoiding it. But they did reveal the Xbox Series X last week out of nowhere at the Game Awards. And that thing is basically a PC. It is a PC gaming tower. And it certainly has enough power, from what we know so far, to do some decent VR.
That's not something I want to put on my TV console. Definitely not.
Well, you know, not everybody... I think we're reaching an interesting point. Not everybody can build a gaming PC, and even doing that is twice as expensive as, like, you know, the power you're going to get in something like the Series X. So, yeah, that's... I think, like, there's a lot of good stuff to look forward to there. Let's get into the stuff that didn't quite work this year for us, Trillin.
I feel like this is my little section, just because...
Trillin's corner of hate. Yeah.
My corner of hate. Basically, I pitched a story for our year-end review roundup saying that 2019 was a really piss-poor year of hype for stuff that's meant to do really well in 2020. That story, I'm not actually writing it, but you'll see it elsewhere in some other stories on Engadget. But yeah, I think that there's a lot of technologies that were hyped up prematurely in 2019. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to start with the most obvious, which is foldables.
I mean, really? You're saying they're too hyped up? Because I seem to remember somebody... What? Somebody just really shooting me down when I'm trying to throw some cold water in foldables. But okay, go on, Trillin.
At the end of 2018, when Samsung teased its Galaxy Fold for the very first time at Samsung Developer Conference, I tweeted out that like I didn't see the point of a foldable phone. Okay. I will say I was one of the haters at the start. I will admit that.
Yeah.
And look, I was proven mostly right in 2019, where like I still don't see a real good use case.
I think anybody with a pair of eyes was proven right. That
yeah.
I don't trust you're going to get this right, Samsung.
No. I mean, some people were really hype about it too in 2018, but 2019 mm-hmm. I think proved that like there's still a ways to go. There's a lot of technology that needs to be figured out. More importantly than the hardware, because I think people will figure out the hardware. More importantly than that is just the software. I think Android needs to work really well to make this happen. Mm-hmm. And you know, show me why I want it. I mean, I've seen foldable devices that I really like. The Huawei Mate X I actually really liked. It just felt sturdier overall.
Is that even that hasn't been released though? That's
no.
Still like, yeah, it's a dream device. It's very nice.
They were going to, but then uh-huh. Samsung ran into all of its issues, and Huawei was like, "Oh crap! Well, we're gonna hold up on
abort,
this for a bit."
Abort. The Moto Razr was very cool. It was a
the
weird
Razr.
Concept.
We closed out the year with the Moto Razr, but throughout the year, right, we saw everyone try. We started off 2019 with Royal FlexPi at CES, and then we saw, you know, the Galaxy Fold come out. We also saw Huawei, Moto, TCL, and all of that. And then we, you know, to be honest, if you look back on this decade, 2011, all right, we actually saw the Kyocera Edge. Do you remember that guy?
Yeah,
have you heard?
I think so. Yeah,
I'm sorry. The Kyocera Echo, might be, is a dual screen Android phone, exclusive to Sprint back then because, you know, exclusives were a thing. And it was a 2 3.5-inch displays running 480 by 800 to become a single 4.7. It was dual screen. And I mean, listen, you were pretty hype about dual screen devices. And I've been trying to tell you that people have been doing this for a decade.
Right.
The Kyocera, the Samsung Hennessy, I believe, the Samsung Hennessy.
Anything
if you
called
remember
Hennessy,
that.
Any device called Hennessy, I will not. Yeah, I'm sorry.
No. That was 2013.
Listen, VR has been in development since the 70s. We saw VR, Sega made a VR headset in the 90s that never quite made it out. Like, these things take a while to get out. I totally agree. The thing I'm planting my flag into this year is the idea that just dual screens make more sense for more devices. So sort of like what Microsoft is doing with the Duo and the Neo, those are two separate screens. They still interact with each other. Windows 10X is this thing that's going to, you know, help Windows move across dual screen devices. Eventually, everything will probably be folding. But I think, you know, look at these dual screen devices. Like there is less of a way for them to fail. You're not moving and folding the actual screen. And that's a good thing, even if it doesn't sound as futuristic as folding your display.
I think it's good. I just think that a dual screen device is harder for me to get on board with because I, you know, like the ZenBook Pro Duo, right? You reviewed that this year.
Did.
That's such a, I couldn't deal with the poor typing experience in general. I've seen other dual screen devices in previous
that's
years.
That's just a keyboard issue though. Like it's, I do feel like the ZenBook Pro Duo, that was the one where it was a giant screen right below the main display, right? And that's interesting. That I could put so much data down there. You could hold three windows down there. Like, I think for people working with timelines or who want to just multitask in a really unique way, that machine is insane. It's
great.
It's much more useful than the screen pad where they were throwing a screen into the actual trackpad.
Yeah. But I mean, I've spoken to a bunch of laptop makers as well recently, and they're, you know, generally on board with both the Neo and Duo style devices. I think that the consensus is that, like you said, the tech is there for dual screens, yes, but it seems like most people want for productivity to have that one uninterrupted display. And that's why foldables are exciting a lot of companies. And so, I mean, we'll see. I just think that this was too much hype this year on foldables, but what we're going to get in the decade to come might actually be super great. And so it just... was lousy with hype.
We're at a really interesting point. It reminds me of, like, you know, it's sort of like 2007 when we saw the iPhone for the first time. Mm. And it was sort of like, you know, this thing's cool. I've never seen a device like this. It doesn't have 3G. It doesn't have, like, some of the things you'd want from other smartphones. And it took Apple a while to even upgrade some of those features. But it was like a statement of what's to come. And it feels like we're at that point. You know, nobody should buy a folding phone right now. But eventually, 5 years or something, maybe they'll be genuinely great. I want, like, a whole array of folding devices. I want folding tablets where, like, it goes from, like, paperback size to, like, full-on, you know, legal style paper size.
We've seen an early version of that, the yoga book.
Yes. Yes.
But still needs a lot of work.
Everything still needs a lot of work. So this is pretty much your category, Shirlin. So what about 5G? You kept hyping up 5G to me. I don't know what happened there.
So I also admit that this is a year of too much hype for 5G. Frankly, the target everyone initially set for 5G to roll out was 2020. No one ever everyone was like, 2020 is when 5G will come out. And then everyone decided to, no, we're going to beat each other. And then
Which is not unusual. Like, that's what happened with 4G.
I know.
That's what happened with LTE. These carriers, which we are owned by a carrier.
Yes.
But all these carriers like to have these I don't know, network measuring contests.
Yeah.
Especially when a new tech comes. Yeah.
So I'm about to take down one carrier or point out one carrier. So I think it behooves me to say that, yes,
sure.
we are employed by Verizon, but they have no real influence over my views. So AT&T started out this year with 5GE.
5G.
Which was incredibly annoying for me as someone who studies 5G.
Because there was nothing 5G about it, right?
Yeah, there was nothing really 5G about it. They just turned on, like, a certain band, I believe, and then just decided to be like, yeah, it's 5G. No, it was not. It got T-Mobile upset. It got every other carrier upset. And this was happening while everyone was at CES. So that was just fun times for everyone covering networking. But then, you know, 5G is a very tricky beast. There were a lot of promises made, but, you know, to get all of those promises fulfilled, there's a lot that has to happen. You'd have to have both millimeter wave turned on and also sub-6 turned on. Mm-hmm. But right now, everyone is rolling out or focusing on the sub-6 rollout because it's just a little bit easier.
Can
the technology
you
for...
quickly explain? So what is sub-6? What is millimeter wave?
Yes.
Why are they different and interesting?
Yeah, so millimeter wave to me is the most interesting, right? It uses the bands in the highest... in the top of the spectrum, which till today hasn't really been used a lot, except for between satellite dishes, because that used to be the size of the equipment you needed to get, you know, millimeter waves to work properly. It's basically because they're so high up there, they're also very short range and they get interrupted very easily. They don't propagate as far. Sub-6, meanwhile, is, you know, below, like, almost on the base level of the spectrum, where they propagate really well, but also hasn't really been used. So what happened was the FCC freed up some space in both ends of the frequent of
that
the
was
spectrum.
From, like, TV spectrum, right? That
they, you mean, sub-6?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah. And so, like, you also will see PSAs going out where the FCC will tell you to, like, try to retune your TV once or twice next year, because some TV channels have had to give up some of their spectrum. Mm-hmm. So basically, you're getting a lot more room for all your data traffic to flow through. And so everything should be faster. I mean, there's other technologies behind the scenes without getting too much into it to make all of this work.
So which one is fast, Sherlyn? Like, millimeter wave is supposed to be fast,
yes,
but it is line of sight. So I feel like that's been the issue. There are a couple companies like Starry here in New York where they have millimeter wave basically home internet. But you gotta be able to point and look at their antennas, which is kind of crazy. You have to hang this thing out of your window. Whereas sub-6 is like, it can work anywhere, but it seems like lower latency, which to me is the more exciting part about 5G, right?
Yeah. That's the two things. Yeah. So sub-6 is the lower latency thing where you'll have internet everywhere and you'll feel like there's no delay in trying to connect to your internet. It just is always there, but
the
it might not be as fast.
You were just surrounded by the force. Yeah.
Or the air. And then for millimeter wave, you can download a movie in like a second, in like literally a few seconds.
Right.
And but the trouble is you need to be like your hand covers your phone a little bit weird, you might not get a signal. Like, that's the difference. But Qualcomm, and we talked about them a while ago, was working on technologies like beamforming and beam tracking to make it easier to pick up a signal, even if you're not necessarily line of sight. It'll bounce.
They're talking about bouncing things off walls. balls and things like that. Yeah.
So anyway, but none of that is out yet. So that's the thing. Like, that's my biggest issue with 5G is that, like, because all the carriers were so eager to compete, no one focused on really just getting the right messaging out there or explaining to consumers what any of this is. And then now there's consumer fatigue. Now people are concerned about other things. People are like, well, what about, you know, the phone? Well, I mean, the phones are also not there yet.
The phones aren't great because 5G uses a ton of battery life. I remember back in the day, those early 4G devices. But Sherlyn, speaking of Qualcomm, what is up with Snapdragon PCs? A thing that I remember you also hyping up and really loving back in the day.
I
feel like those are related to 5G as well, right? That's a whole like continuum of stuff from them.
So again, relating back to hype, this year I think Snapdragon PCs got an extra dose of hype because the Surface Pro X released. I would say that like the Snapdragon PC movement was kind of trucking along on its own. They announced the 8CX last year at the Tech Summit in Hawaii last December.
That is the chip that they were really aiming to be in laptops, right?
Yeah, they called the 8CX, the X stood for extreme. You know what I mean? Like, they were like, this is extreme power.
This is extreme arm. Okay.
Yeah, so I was like, all right, you know, I could see, you know, something potentially happening. The first device to really supposedly ship with 8CX was supposed to be the Galaxy Book S, mm-hmm. which we saw at the Note 10 event around August or September, but it never really came out. And then the Pro X was the first one to really ship with a variant of the chip. So we didn't really see it come out. And honestly, even though the Pro X was just bad, like, come on.
Well, I don't know if it's a chip that's the fault. It's more like Windows and the ability for like those like there aren't enough apps, right? There are things that just don't work.
Exactly. So my problem with it, it's not the hardware, it's not the power. I think we've hit a point where the power actually could be fine if certain issues were ironed out, like Chrome support needs to be better. But the biggest problem I have with it, and we've talked about this in a previous episode, but my biggest problem is that they don't make it clear what apps are compatible or not. You'll just go to like a random download.com and then it'll just be like random 64-bit apps and you're going to try and download, but nothing during the process is going to tell you whether or not it'll work until you install it and you try to use it and it's like,
but you have
sorry.
To learn that you just don't go to the, like the only things you can install are in the Windows Store, basically. Like the Microsoft
Which
Store.
Which is a very limited library.
That is the problem.
If you give people a real desktop environment with a real desktop browser, people are still going to go to the internet and look for mm-hmm. like something like an EXE they can download. So
there is some training. This reminds me of like when the original Surface RT launched. And it was such a mess because that was pretty much the first Windows on ARM device. And yeah, you couldn't run any old apps. It was all very confusing. And I still don't know what the real appeal is. Like, I guess if you can give me a PC that is 1 pound, super, like the lightest laptop I've ever seen, you know, then I'm like, okay, give me that mobile hardware.
Okay, but it's not just that, right? My favorite thing about Snapdragon PC so far has been LTE everywhere. And in future, 5G everywhere,
maybe. That'd be nice, too.
You know, honestly, 5G could make a lot of things better. And it's bringing a lot of promise to things like, Snapdragon PCs, but also game streaming. Like, the promise of game streaming was mm-hmm. huge this year. We had Stadia launch. We had xCloud was, you know, launched as
xCloud
a test.
xCloud is in beta. Yeah.
It's a test, yeah. So, not fully launched, but this is the year that, like, game streaming honestly got a lot of hype, I think, because of Stadia.
But,
and
yeah.
Unfortunately.
Rewind to earlier in this run of this podcast, where I said Google was bad at rolling out products. Stadia is a disaster as a product. It is clearly they should have been like, guys, let's wait 6 months. Let's just wait until everything is ready to launch this. But meanwhile, Google basically rushed to launch Stadia this year to some of those early adopter users. You had a great chat with Jess Condit about like how it works and everything there. Like I don't know why they did this. They didn't have to just run and do this. But yeah, it is a problem of the tech is great, but the execution is terrible. And Google just has not thought about how people use products.
As a refresher, I mean, like, remember, this is Stadia service currently doesn't run on mobile data. xCloud does. Then there's like compatibility issues where like some controllers will work with like a thing. Some won't. If you want to play on your Pixel, you have to use the Pixel supplied controller.
If you want to play on your Chromecast. You can only use the Stadia controller with that. But
if you want to play on your phone or laptop, you can try another Bluetooth controller, sure. But if you use the Google one, they only provide like a 6-inch cable, which means you have to be stuck to your
phone.
No, that
makes sense, though, because when you guys were talking about that, the reason that cable's so short is because it is meant for accessories that plug your phone on top of a controller. So it is supposed to be a really, really short connection. That was the whole point.
What if you use it with your laptop?
Well, then you need a longer controller. But that short, like, everybody has long cables, short cables, to really make something like a handheld controller accessory that holds your phone more usable.
Okay.
Like, short cables are harder to find. So that was why they did that.
Okay,
so
that's one thing they got sense. Right. Yeah, well done. But everything
there,
else,
there should be
you
two
know.
Cables. There should be a short cable and a long cable. There should be, this should be a service where you're just getting the games by subscribing to it and not having to pay for everything Stadia and then having to pay for a separate copy of a game.
Yep.
Like, the whole idea that Stadia is this thing where you're investing in a game library where they could just Google Reader it and kill it, you know, in a year or two. It just seems like such a waste of money and effort. It works. And certainly when 5G is here. So the dream of game streaming is that I'm anywhere. I'm just sitting and waiting and I could just, you know, pull out my phone and start playing Overwatch or something. The idea of fast, low latency internet available everywhere. That's a dream come true. That's going to enable all sorts of things like game streaming. Even VR streaming is a thing people are talking about. Like, eventually, something like the Oculus Quest won't even need to be plugged into a PC to get a higher end VR experience. Like, you will just get that data over the internet. But VR is the high, like, that is the ultimate test case, because any sort of latency in VR, any sort of like slowdown will, you know, literally make your stomach turn and will lead to people vomiting. So, like, that, once we do VR over 5G perfectly, I feel like we'll have succeeded. But that's going to take a while. It's going to take many, many years. One more thing that I think we're seeing more of this year, smart speakers, security cameras. Things are not going so well.
Well, so listen, I actually am pretty, you know, excited for smart home tech because, you know, I think 2010s was the decade that smart home tech became a thing.
Yeah, rewind to Sherlin in 2012. Smart home, smart home, smart home. Every year at CES, man.
Well, listen.
I'm sorry, you were in middle school then, so I can't.
Exactly. I was still in school. I can't even talk to you about this. Not really. I feel like the Echo really only came out the first gen, like 2014, 2015-ish time frame.
Yeah. And that was the like best, good, desirable smart home device.
Yes.
I wrote up a love letter to it in Gadget. Yeah.
Yeah, it really pushed things forward. And then now here we are. Smart speakers are prevalent, I think. And we got security cameras in everyone's homes. But then, unfortunately, we found out that, you know, all of the major companies hire contractors to listen to your commands and understand what you're saying, I guess. But then, you know, who stores that data? I mean, if your third-party contractors may not be bound by the same rules or the same principles that these companies say they are. And so there might be a, you know, giant database farm or server farm somewhere with every single word you've said in your home. So I think that, like, I'm not as paranoid as most people on that front.
These companies should have just told us what is happening. And that was the problem. Like, I wasn't surprised that, obviously they're taking clips and trying to, like, optimize the voice tech. Like, this stuff won't get better without them doing that. But just tell us, guys. Like, let me opt into this. Let me be like, oh, I'm contributing to the future of the Alexa platform by opening up some, you know, device data. Maybe I can turn it on and off, like, when I want to have a public conversation and a slightly more private one. Like, control would be great. And then speaking of Amazon, Ring has been kind of a disaster.
I didn't mean to scream. So security cameras are a whole other part of the issue here. I mean, not only is Ring, I mean, Ring has been in the news a lot lately for, like, handing over your, you know, security camera footage to law enforcement, but they also
they're like selling the idea of Ring cameras as this, like, surveillance network across America. Like, they have deals with police departments, and the police departments are trying to push Ring cameras into the communities. Like, this is insidious. This is some RoboCop level garbage. Yeah.
To tone it down just ever so slightly, I mean, I think these are warranted concerns, but, like, every single security camera right now, also in New York, for example, is accessible by the police more or less to, like, you know, do face recognition.
Right, but they've been deployed by the NYPD, and I have my issues with that. We are living in a surveillance state, but those cameras have all been deployed by the NYPD. I know to be wary of what those things are. I am not as, like, I feel like I shouldn't be as worried about something I plug into my home, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that is a very, very different thing.
I mean, you are right, because, like, they also have had a recent string of hacks and breaches where one of the most recent incidents actually involved a person who hacked, I guess, a Ring camera that was sitting in the room of a little girl, 8 years old, and then watched footage of her and, like, say things to her. And so that's just terrible. I mean, that to me is awful. And to your point, these things are being placed in, like, our more private places and intimate spaces. So this was just such a mess.
And that's been happening with baby monitors for years, too. That is also why a lot of people do not recommend Wi-Fi enabled baby monitors. I use one that uses, like, RF wireless at home, so I still get video, but I can't see it outside my house. I don't mind. It's okay. It's fine.
Yeah, I mean, look, what are we going to... So smart home basically developed a lot over this past decade, but it's still kind of a mess. And we heard good news.
Still a dumb home, yeah.
It's still... We heard some good news this week that, like, I guess it's good news, right? Apple, Google, and Amazon are teaming up to do an open source smart home standard with a terrible name that I'm not going to say on here because it's just terrible.
P-Troip. What? No, no. You got to say the name, Sherlyn. Say the name and describe the name because it's disastrous.
Oh, my Lord. Do you want to hear the name of the standard?
Yes.
Connected Home over IP standard. If you throw in the word project behind it, it's called Project Connected Home over IP.
P-Troip. Yeah, that's really going to solve all our problems.
That acronym that Devendra is yelling at y'all, P-Troip, is literally what you would get if you took the first letters. Project Connected Home over IP, or P-Troip. It sounds like a Chinese dish, or I'm hungry. Like, I don't know. So yeah, I mean, listen, it's potentially good news.
It's great. This is the thing smart homes have needed for a decade. So yes. It's good news. It's just dumb.
I want them to be very careful about the security standards inside this protocol. So, well, let's see, right? Hopefully this will mean better cross-platform interaction. You don't have to worry about whether your smart light bulb that you're buying is going to work with Alexa, Siri, or Google Home.
No, I totally agree. Like, I've been following smart home for a while. In my house right now, I have Philips Hue lights. I have a random assortment of, like, Wemo switches. They all use different apps. They all, like, are connected to different things and different hubs. And it's a mess. It's a disaster. But I think the best thing so far has been the Alexa and when things integrate with that. I'm hoping this is the sort of thing we needed a decade ago. We have had standards. We had Z-Wave and Zigbee and all these different things. Everyone chose different standards to accept, and that made it very tough to build a smart home because nothing talked to each other. So yeah, this is good. I hope it leads to something real. Our hate fest is over. We can look with bright eyes to 2020. What's really, like, the things exciting you about next year? And what can we expect to see?
So everything that we've talked about so far, whether it's hype or good stuff, right? Imagine all of that empowered and made better by 5G, right? Real 5G, proper 5G, with both millimeter wave and sub-6 activated. That's
what
I'm looking forward to.
We know what Sherlyn's new middle name is going to be.
Good Lord. Sherlyn 5G low.
Sherlyn sub-6 low.
No, Sherlyn, I'm more hype about millimeter
wave low. Yeah,
there we go.
Sherlyn low spectrum. Yeah.
There's also dynamic spectrum sharing. Let's not even... Anyway.
Yeah.
We
may see the 5G iPhone next year. And I feel like that will be the thing. That's like, once Apple does it, and Apple gets a lot of flack for being late to things, but once they figure out how to make a smartphone that doesn't lose its battery life over 5G and work well, that's competition. Then the Android people are going to have to be better, too.
I think that I'm not even looking for 5G next year. I'm thinking 5G in 5 years. I'm thinking... You know, eventually when it does roll out on a much fuller level, that, like, it's going to be great. I love having internet everywhere. I'm going to not talk to humans ever again. I'm just going
to be in VR
on the go.
I think it's going to make the idea of home internet, the idea of having, like, home service, as obsolete as getting home telephone service. That is what I want. Because right now, in my apartment, I'm currently living through an internet outage that has been lasting for days and is very... Yeah. It's very obtuse. I can't tell, like, when things are going to get fixed or what's actually wrong. Meanwhile, I've been just hotspotting devices here and there as I need them. And, like, the cellular works. It's fine. It may not be stable enough to do a podcast right now, but it works for what I need. So 5G, that's great. That's going to be like, yeah, you will get good internet everywhere. That's a great thing. We talked a bit about the dual screen and folding devices. I do think next year we know the Surface Duo and the Surface Neo are coming. I am super hyped for those. I feel like I shouldn't be because Microsoft tends to disappoint me when I get very excited for something. But, you know, a nice pocketable Courier-like dual screen device. Like, come on, give me that. That's
you
what
and
I've
your
been
nostalgia.
Dreaming of.
You
it's
and
not,
your nostalgia.
It's not just nostalgia. It is the thing. It is like thing I would really want. Like right now, when I'm doing this podcast with you, Sherlyn, I have a laptop open. I have like our show notes. I have all this stuff. I have my phone nearby. If I could just like fold open my phone a little more to get a better sense of like these show notes or something. If I could just be more flexible about how I worked and consume data, I feel
or
like
multitask.
That would be super useful. Yeah, or multitask. That's the sort of thing I've been looking forward to for a while. That's the future I want. I want to go into the next decade with this futuristic tech. You know, smartphones are great, but they've gotten a little boring.
And I think we will. I do think that we'll see a lot of these. Not again, we say 2020 as next year, but I think of 2020 as the beginning of a new decade. And so
sure.
I think in the next decade, we're going to get a lot of improvement.
And yes, nerds, I know 2021 is technically the beginning of the next decade. We know, but normal humans, I think, will celebrate 2020 as a new beginning, the end of bad things in America, like bad things in general. Yeah. So dual screen devices, you know I'm excited. A thing we haven't really talked much about is 360-degree audio. And this is something Sony's pushing with their 360 reality audio. Dolby Atmos music is a thing. This is the idea where you can get a single speaker, something that looks like a HomePod. Amazon's new Echo Studio is technically a 360-degree speaker. It has speakers all around. It can fill a room with sound and also make you feel as if you're listening to a live session. Like it sort of like puts you there. I've heard some demos of the Sony stuff, both on speakers and headphones. It's really interesting. It's sort of like super surround sound. It is the idea of recreating just being in a room, listening to a live band. And, you know, this sounds a little gimmicky, but as somebody who likes music and likes new tech, to me, it's a little more interesting than like high resolution audio, which is a thing so many people have been pushing for so long. I believe Neil Young has been really trying hard to do that. You know, it's that stuff sounds good, but this sounds transformational and could be the stuff we're listening to, everyone's listening to in 10 years. So really looking forward to that.
That is a very niche pick, I will say, but a little bit broader and still quite niche, I will say. I'm
okay, Miss Snapdragon PC.
Wow.
That everybody wants.
Everyone wants a Snapdragon, listen. Well, I'm interested in the new consoles. I'm not a gaming girl, but I am. I mean, I have found a Nintendo Switch that I'm about to buy for a very good deal, secondhand. But anyway, so I'm starting to be interested in gaming, and I think that next year is going to be the year of big consoles like the PS5.
You could say the A word. It's fine.
Can I say the A word? Okay, big ass consoles.
Big ass consoles. Because the Xbox Series X, which is Microsoft just clarified, is not the official, like, the Series X is a type of Xbox, but the next generation Xbox is just called Xbox. It's all very confusing. They suck at naming things. But yeah, that thing is powerful. The PlayStation 5 is powerful. Like, this is cool new hardware. We saw some demos from the Game Awards, by the way. Look up the trailer for Senua, Hellblade 2, Senua something or other. But that trailer is all in-engine. That is the processing power of the device. And it looks like a really realistic, really well done CG movie. It looks insane. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'm really looking forward to see like what Microsoft does with all its game services. This is a bit of a tangent, but I feel like Xbox All Access is one of those great things. Like it is a subscription service that gives me Xbox Live. I get some games every month. I was able to play, you know, The Outer Worlds without paying for it full price. And I also get games on my PC. All that will carry over to the next system. All that also carries over to xCloud. And Microsoft has built this great unified system of gaming. It's not like Stadia where you have to go and buy every game again. It's just all your Xbox games are going to be in the cloud. So that's all cool. Unified stuff. I wonder how Sony's going to compete with that.
Basically, I think that in 2020 and beyond, we're going to see us yard closer to the world of Black Mirror.
I mean, we're already there. I feel like we'll talk more about Black Mirror at some point, but the failure of that show right now is that the world is a disastrous Black Mirror episode, and the show itself is not kept up with that. It's been a good year. I'm very glad we were able to get this podcast off the ground once again. Give us a sense of what you're working on? I guess what we're all working on, right?
We're all working on CES, you guys. I mean, listen, it's been CES season. I mean, Devendra and I talk about how we would love a break around the holiday season, but for me, it's just endless meetings with companies, looking at fielding my inbox of like meeting requests at CES and having to decide like what is worth looking at and what's not really all that moving
filling
the needle.
Filling out spreadsheets, filling out calendars, basically booking blocking out a whole week of your time. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think people, you know, may think from the outside that it looks like a lot of fun, and it is a lot of fun a lot of the time,
but it's
also a lot of work. So in addition to being sick and trying to get our year-end coverage up, I'm also doing a lot of CES prep, so you might not see anything from me on the website for a while, but I am doing a lot of behind the scenes stuff.
A lot of stuff is happening. I will give you my background story of CES. My very first CES, it was not flashy. My editor booked me at a seedy motel right on the strip, like right in front of traffic, basically. I didn't get a budget to even take taxis, which is a disaster in Las Vegas. So, you know, nothing will ever be as bad as that first CES for me. So that's what I'm going to take. And I'm always excited to see the new tech. We've gotten some previews. Our next episode, which is going to be after Christmas, we're going to take next week off. We are going to dive into some of the stuff we expect to see at CES. So it'll be a bit of a preview. And I'm hoping we can get some stuff done during the show as well to give you guys some on the ground coverage. Okay, so let's wrap things up for the week, for the year. I'm going to talk about my Engadget pick, which is, I guess, going to be kind of an anti-pick. I saw Star Wars Rise of Skywalker at an early screening here in New York, and you can tell from my tone, I'm not too happy with it. I wrote up a quick review at Engadget. It is a disappointing movie after Last Jedi, a movie that I love completely.
So this is your pick, or is this like your recommendation to not go?
No, people are going to go. It's Star Wars. People are going to go. But my pick is, listen to me rant about bad Star Wars, okay? Over at Slash Film, we have a full review. We recorded like 2 hours of this thing, of just like debating this movie. But it is a mess. It is a shame. And I wish, I just wish it was better. Yeah, I guess a good pick. A good pick would be The Expanse, which is back on Amazon. That's some good space stuff. No dumb like plot mechanics of a Star Wars. Anyway, Sherlyn, what is up with you? What are you digging?
I was going to make up for your lack of an actual pick by, you know, recommending two things. Now, one, you know, because I'm such a hardcore gamer, I want to recommend this game called Jackbox Party Pack. It's not one game, actually. The Party Pack is a set of six or five games. And, you know, it's not the newest thing, but they do have the new Party Pack 6 that came out recently enough. You know, this is the season to be with your family and friends. You're going to all be sitting in the living room watching TV together. Sure. But why not play a fun game like Trivia Murder Party 2?
Yes.
Which, it's amazing.
Jackbox,
I love Trivia.
Jackbox is great for that. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, these are the people who made You Don't Know Jack. And there's famous, like the more well-known games like Quiplash or I guess Gespionage is a good game. There's Drawful, which is but the newest Party Pack has, again, Murder Party 2, which I love, the first one. So I'm really excited for that one. Dictionarium, which is like, I guess you make up words. Push the Button, which is a hidden identity game. Joke Boat, which, I guess, like, you have to come up with jokes. And,
are you playing this on a computer or what?
So that's
it's on
a great
Switch now too. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a great thing about the Jackbox series is that they're like on basically every platform.
They're everywhere.
They're on Android TVs. What I do is I get them on Steam, which is really weird, I guess, for playing on a TV. But you can actually cast your laptop screen to a TV, which I did recently at a friend's place for Thanksgiving. My friends also play on their Xbox, which is hooked up to their TV. So you get it wherever you want. There's a bunch of it's really available on basically every platform. The other thing I wanted to recommend, I spent a lot of time thinking last night when I had to pick a pick. And I turned on the TV and I was watching Ellen's Greatest Night of Giveaways, which is this really feel-good show. And it just got me thinking like how amazing it feels to, if you're in a position of privilege like Ellen DeGeneres is, to just give and to help people. I literally sat on my couch sobbing, watching people who really benefited Yeah, she was giving people cars and like a and money and people who really seemed like they needed it, right? And so I would say my other recommendation this holiday season is, as you're giving gifts to your family and friends and loved ones, consider giving to, you know, a charity that needs it. It's easy enough to find a charity that you support. I give monthly to the ACLU and like a no-kill animal shelter. But I also try to use smile.amazon.com, which is it donates a portion of the money you spend on Amazon to a charity of your selection.
Nice.
Yeah, so instead of always shopping at Amazon.com, and if you're on your browser, consider smile.amazon.com. I don't know if a lot of people know of it, but there you go.
That's cool. That's cool. Well, good to know that you're such a giver, I guess.
I am. I give and I give and I never take. That's not true. Well, that's it for our show this week, everyone. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, or talking about movies and TV at slashfilm.com.
If you want to tell me to get my flu shot, I'm at Sherlyn Lowe on Twitter. Please, please send us any questions or feedback at podcast@engadget.com. Make sure to leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on literally anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. As a reminder, we're taking next week off because everyone should enjoy the holidays, but keep an eye out the week after for our CES preview, which will be in the first days of 2020.